This episode contains discussion and description of domestic violence. Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin, and today on the pod, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Vicky Shabo, who is the Vice President of the National Partnership for Women and Families, because this week is the 25th anniversary of the Family Medical Leave Act, or FMLA, which gives workers up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave to take care of themselves, a sick family member, or to care for a new child. We had a great discussion about FMLA, what it's done, and what it leaves out.
Startling fact that just 15% of the workforce has paid family leave through their jobs. And for low-wage workers, it's only 4%. So we're leaving out more than 100 million workers.
But before we get into that discussion, I want to start with some listener feedback. I got a great email from Katie. She said, "Hi, Devin. I wanted to push back on just a bit of the rhetoric in the pro-abortion versus pro-choice discussion from Monday's pod. Drexel referred to the choice of whether to have an abortion as one of the, quote, hardest decisions for a woman to make, and you called it a, quote, horrendous choice. I have had an abortion. For me, it was not a difficult decision at all. I knew that what was what I wanted to do. That doesn't mean there was nothing difficult about the experience, but the decision itself was not something I struggled with. I can only speak for myself, but I suspect there are many who felt that way about their abortions, too. The reason I bring this up is that I think the common narrative that whether to have an abortion is always difficult and terrible choice is just as harmful as saying abortion should be rare. If we are made to feel that we are supposed to struggle with this decision, then that is adding just as much shame and stigma." Thank you, Katie, so much for your feedback. You are absolutely right. And it's something I had never really thought about before. I haven't had an abortion. I've never been in a position to have an abortion. So I just assumed that it would be a horrendous choice, as I said on Monday. But you're right. We shouldn't add to the shame and stigma. There shouldn't be one more thing that women are supposed to feel or supposed to do. If having an abortion is the right decision for you, it doesn't necessarily have to be a hard choice. Like Katie said, the decision part wasn't difficult. It's what needed to happen. And I think that is so important to remember when we talk about how women's health care should be normalized, and whether that is with abortion care, which, as I said on Monday, I am pro-abortion because I am pro putting abortion back into the healthcare flow of conversation. It's not about abortion as separate from healthcare. But in order to do that, we have to normalize and take away stigma from the procedure. And like Katie said, from the decision to have the procedure, there is nothing wrong with having an abortion. There's nothing wrong to struggle with that choice. And there's nothing wrong with not struggling to make that choice. And I think that Katie is absolutely right that we need to reframe the way we talk about abortion, not just in the sense of what abortion is in general, but about the decision-making process as well. So I also want to talk about domestic violence. Normally, I don't do a news section on Thursdays because we have the interview, but something happened this week that I feel is really important to talk about. So I guess we'll call this a little in-episode Devin's Dumpster Fire Debrief, which is the name of the little segment I do on our Instagram stories. And this story is right now about a man named Rob Porter. He was the staff secretary for Trump. He was essentially a gatekeeper and controlled what got to Trump's desk. And that is a powerful role, and he was one of the top paid staffers at the White House. But he was denied a security clearance and was operating with a temporary one, a la the Kush, because his background check revealed domestic violence allegations from his ex-wife. It is reported that his first wife, Colby Holderness, told the FBI about the domestic violence that occurred during the marriage and even showed them a picture of her with a black eye given to her by Rob Porter. And last year, Porter's second wife, Jennifer Willoughby, wrote about her abusive marriage. She wrote, quote, "When I tried to get help, I was counseled to consider carefully how what I said might affect his career. And so I kept my mouth shut and stayed." Let's just take a minute to let that sink in. an abused woman was counseled by someone that her husband's career was more important than her safety. That alone is chilling, but it is worse when you consider that, according to the CDC, in a report released in the year 2017, half of all female homicides are committed by an intimate partner. So women are told to stay silent so their husbands' careers aren't impacted when being murdered is a possibility for them. And that's just terrifying. And on Wednesday, Porter resigned, although he hasn't actually left office yet. He is staying on to, quote, ensure a smooth transition. But it was also Wednesday, after Porter resigned, that Chief of Staff John Kelly, who I feel like is this like sleeper racist and sleeper misogynist that we don't pay enough attention to. Everyone thinks that John Kelly brings this sense of order to Trump's chaotic White House. But I think that that is absolutely a false narrative. So John Kelly came to Porter's defense. He said that Porter was a, quote, man of true integrity and honor. And Kelly knew about these allegations against Porter when he made that statement. And then later on Wednesday, he tried to walk it back a little bit. And he said he was, quote, shocked by the allegations, but he still stood by Porter. He said, again, I'm quoting, there is no place for domestic violence in our society. I stand by my previous comments of the Rob Porter I have come to know since becoming chief of staff and believe every individual deserves the right to defend their reputation. And here we are, back at defending men's reputations and careers above protecting the women that they abuse. It is also worth noting that Kelly did not change his view of Porter even after seeing the pictures of his ex-wife with a black eye, because it didn't matter. Women are, as a general rule, not believed on their word. But even when there is proof, when there's a picture, there's still this idea that she might have, quote, deserved what she got, or that it still doesn't really matter, because the allegations of two of his ex-wives weren't enough to make him anything but a, quote, honorable man in John Kelly's opinion. And so why would a photograph change that? That didn't surprise me at all. And the White House knew about these allegations going back for months. That he was allowed to resign, he wasn't even fired, only after these allegations left the confines of the White House where he had been protected by White House staff, is a testament to how women are treated and viewed in this country, and particularly under this administration. And Porter isn't even the first man in Trump's White House to have a history of domestic violence. And I'm just hitting the highlights here. I am sure there are way more that we don't know about, or that it's simply not known, because domestic violence is a crime of silence often. But let's just hit a couple here. Steve Bannon, who led the Trump campaign and then later had a made up but extremely high level position in the White House, was, quote, charged with misdemeanor domestic violence, battery, and dissuading a witness following an incident in January 1996. That was his wife. The charges were ultimately dropped because the court couldn't locate his wife, who was the complainant, to testify. But the situation was that he threw a phone at her and was yelling, and he was charged with domestic violence and battery. And still, that didn't seem to matter to anyone when he was on the Trump campaign or in the goddamn White House. So let's go back a little bit further too. Andy Puzner, who is an executive of Carl's Jr. and one-time labor secretary nominee of Trump's. He was accused of domestic violence by his ex-wife, Lisa Feirstein. She said that he told her, quote, I will see you in the gutter. This will never be over. You will pay for this. She did this on a panel on the Oprah show in 1990, though she did retract her statement later, and that seems to be a pattern here. Right. A woman comes forward and says something, and then Steve Bannon was charged with dissuading a witness because his wife couldn't be located. This woman retracts her statement after it becomes public. And, you know, you really have to wonder why. So while Pudzer ultimately removed himself from the running for labor secretary, Trump reportedly, quote, really likes him and is trying to find him a high level job in the White House. And that takes us to Trump himself. He has been accused of all sorts of sexual abuse by dozens of women, dozens. And that goes back to his first wife and mother of three of his children, Ivana Trump. In her autobiography, she said that Trump raped her. Michael Cohen, Trump's personal lawyer, actually said in real life that it is, quote, impossible to rape your spouse, which is A, disgusting, and B, not true. Though I will take a second to point out that marital rape laws have only been on the books since 1993. That is 25 years ago. That was the same year that FMLA, that we're talking about later, was signed. I'm almost speechless. I'm only almost speechless because this is not new. I mean, it is clear that this administration takes a poor view of women and has no interest in protecting them, though they are all about protecting and advancing the careers of abusive men. But this isn't new. It's just rape culture is so ingrained in our everyday lives that something like this, while shocking that it's come out, isn't shocking to the women who have been in this position. Domestic violence is a poison that seeps into every life. It affects women of every class, race, and sexual orientation. Though African-American women experience intimate partner violence at a rate of 35% higher than that of white females and about 2.5 times the rate of women of other races. 1 out of 4 to 1 out of 3 same-sex relationships has experienced domestic violence. And 1 in 3 women have been victims of some form of physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime. And 1 in 4 women have been victims of severe physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime. And let's not forget that 50% of all female homicides are perpetrated by an intimate partner. So it is likely that someone you know, or maybe even yourself, has endured some form of domestic violence. And while this particular discussion has been about physical violence, there's also emotional abuse and financial abuse. So if you or someone you know is struggling with domestic violence, the domestic violence hotline is 1-800-799-7233. That's 1-800-799-7233. And this is a pervasive issue. And it is so disgusting that we live in a time that this not only still happens, but that even if you commit domestic violence, it doesn't seem like there are any ramifications. On a slightly lighter note, I would like to announce the Hellion of the Week. I think most of you have guessed by this point that the Hellion of the Week is Nancy Pelosi. So, badass motherfucker Nancy Pelosi set a record yesterday. She gave an 8-hour, 4-minute speech on the House floor to oppose the budget deal, to lift spending caps, and avert a government shutdown because the plan does not address immigration issues. She read stories from DACA recipients and biblical passages about taking care of each other and made it clear that she would not be supporting any sort of spending bill that did not address immigration reform and the Dreamers specifically. And Paul Ryan, demon from the depths of Steve Bannon's butthole, is refusing to bring an immigration bill to the floor of the House for debate. This signals not only her commitment to a clean Dream Act, but also to the ideals that make her a great leader. Nancy Pelosi is not a perfect person, and she has made mistakes. She has done things that I do not agree with. She has made awful gaffes just in the last year, but she is one of my all-time idols. This is a woman who does not fuck around. She has no tolerance for bullshit, and she will not back down. She will stand for 8 hours in 4-inch heels because she believes in a better future, and that is what I want from my politicians. That is what I want from my leaders and my representatives. I want them to stand up for what they believe in, what they believe is right, and not back down, even when you're the minority, even when you don't have any power, even when the House Speaker is a demon from Steve Bannon's butthole. She's there and she's fighting. She said, quote, "We have to be strong as a country to respect the aspirations of people who are our future. The young people are our future, and these Dreamers are part of that. They've been enriched by the greatness of our country. The fact that we can't get a clean Dream Act and that this spending bill, it does not have comprehensive immigration reform, despite what asshole Mitch McConnell tried to promise the Democrats when they voted for this extension 3 weeks ago, says a lot about where we are as a country and what we believe. I hope that we can all take something away from Nancy Pelosi, badass motherfucker, who is fighting for what she believes in. And I also want to give you my favorite tweet, possibly of all time, from @KLVD Comedy. She said, quote, The secret to standing in stilettos for 7+ hours is to imagine yourself standing on Paul Ryan's neck and lean all the way into it. Grantland alumni Molly Lambert, Tess Lynch, and Emily Yoshida bring you a weekly podcast to keep you company during lonely nights and strange days. It is a podcast as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It's the meeting place between alien documentaries and Frasier, between breaking pop culture news and, wait, how did Molly think Billy Joel was Italian? It's a brand new podcast from Audio Boom called Night Call. Every Monday, our bi-coastal hosts sit down for a free jazz blend of pop culture, internet culture, and just enough half-baked conspiracy theories to keep things interesting. Drop them a line with your night call at 24046-NIGHT. That's 24046-NIGHT, and they'll offer you their best advice on life, love, and the coming apocalypse. Night Call is available now on Apple Podcasts and all other listening destinations. So for those of you who have tinfoil hat hair about the Russia investigation, this is a podcast for you. Today's guest is Vicky Szabo. Vicky is Vice President for Workplace Policies and Strategies at the National Partnership for Women and Families and is one of the nation's leading experts on paid family and medical leave. Szabo is responsible for the strategic direction of the National Partnership's work to promote fair and family-friendly workplaces, including efforts to advance paid leave, paid sick days, expansion and enforcement of FMLA or the Family and Medical Leave Act. So welcome, Vicky. Thank you so much for being here.
Devin, I'm so excited to be with you. You have such a great show.
Thank you so much. So let's just jump right in. So this week, I believe, is the 25th anniversary of the Family and Medical Leave Act or FMLA. Can you explain what FMLA is and a little bit of the struggle it took to get it passed in 1994?
I will. 1993. So it was the very first. It was a 9-year fight. It was the very first bill that Bill Clinton signed when he became president. And the Family and Medical Leave Act says that if you have a new child through birth or adoption or foster placement, you're caring for a seriously ill parent, child, or spouse. You have your own serious health condition, or since the late 2000s, if you're dealing with a military service member's need or your own military family need, you can take time out of the workplace to do that for up to 12 weeks a year, 26 for military caregiving. But what the FMLA doesn't do is cover everybody who needs it. It leaves out about 40% of the workforce. And it doesn't offer paid leave. It only guarantees job protection for unpaid leave. And so that makes leave virtually impossible for millions of people a year to take. It was an important step, though. So if you think back 25 years, this was really the beginning of an emerging conversation about women in the workforce and in the type of modern arrangements that we have where women were in full-time work. There weren't family caregivers home anymore to take care of kids or seriously ill parents. And yet leave was really uncommon. When you look back at the statistics from that time, even unpaid leave was out of reach for many, many people, and employers weren't giving people the time they needed to care for a baby or deal with a serious medical issue. So the National Partnership for Women and Families, which was then called the Women's Legal Defense Fund, realized that we needed to take action. So back in 1984, legend, and I believe truth, says that we wrote the first draft of the law on a typewriter in our old office space. And we led the advocacy coalition for 9 years over two vetoes from President George H.W. Bush until it passed. And it was the first law that Bill Clinton signed. And it's been used more than 200 million times since 1993 by people. And it really has been culture changing and for many people, life changing. But it certainly was considered to be a first step at the time and has been something that we have strived very hard to improve upon, primarily through state and local policy advances since that time.
Yeah, you mentioned that it only applies in certain circumstances. Can you explain a little bit what those circumstances are?
Yeah, so it applies to workers in businesses with 50 or more employees, those who have worked more than 1,250 hours in a year, and those who have been on the job with their employer for more than a year. And that's why, as I said, it leaves out millions of workers. It covers about 60% of the workforce. Once you add in whether a person or a family can afford to take unpaid leave without causing substantial financial hardship, the usability drops to just about 40% or less of the workforce. And there are huge disparities by race and ethnic origin, and you know, certainly, obviously, by job type and wage level.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned kind of a race factor here. Is that something that's very pronounced? Is that something that FMLA or National Partnership keeps track of?
Yeah, and actually there's some great research out of the Heller School at Brandeis University that's done some terrific data analysis work, crunching all of the numbers and looking at those disparities. But Latino families actually suffer the worst, least likely to have access to FMLA, and then certainly least likely to be able to afford an unpaid leave. That's where we see the sharpest differences. And this is substantial and significant because what this means is that we are reinforcing the inequality that exists. So you're taking the workers who are least able to afford unpaid leave and the least likely to be offered paid leave through their employers. You're asking them to take leave without pay, dipping into savings, potentially turning to public assistance, borrowing from friends and family, or foregoing the leave that they need to care for a child or to care for a family member or themselves. And that leads to worse outcomes over time. There's huge correlation between taking paid leave and the ability of newborns to get to the doctor, to breastfeed, for moms who are dealing with postpartum depression or recovery from childbirth, for older workers who, when they take time out of the workforce to care for an aging parent and have to leave work, are losing hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And those disparities only get magnified over time as families have less and less equity built up and less income coming in.
Yeah. You say that taking yourself out of the workforce too, especially for older workers, the FMLA states that companies must, quote, restore the employee to their original position or an equivalent position with equivalent pay and benefits. Do you know that people who take FMLA find that they are restored to the original positions, or is there usually a shift, or do they lose money or job title, which I know is illegal, but does it happen?
It does happen. In the Obama administration, the Department of Labor actually did a fantastic job investing in investigators and enforcement around FMLA and tying FMLA enforcement to other wage and hour violations. So if they're going in to investigate Fair Labor Standards Act violations, minimum wage and overtime violations, they were also looking at FMLA. With this administration, we haven't seen a lot there. And we'll be watching and waiting to see how FMLA enforcement proceeds.
I couldn't find anything. Does the Secretary of Labor, Alexander Acosta, have a position on FMLA, or has he made any statement about FMLA?
That's a great question. I'm thinking back to his confirmation hearings, and I don't recall anything specific.
I couldn't find anything.
The department itself, the Trump administration in the last budget that it put out, proposed cuts to the Department of Labor. We'll see next week when the budget comes out what that looks like. And of course, with the tax bill going through and less revenue available, and of course, we're in the middle of a budget fight now. We'll see sort of how that shakes out. But, you know, in the Bush administration, the Department of Labor was really starved of resources, and it took a long time in those 8 years of the Obama administration to build it back up. So we're watching and we and partners are monitoring what the Department of Labor does.
Right. I think a lot of people think if they know what FMLA is or when they hear it, they think of it as pregnancy leave a lot of times. So I imagine that ties it very closely to women's issues, but it's not just women that can take the FMLA, but are they usually the ones that do so?
That's a great question, Devin. Access to leave is absolutely not just a women's issue. It's an economic issue. It's a family issue. When we look at the data For new children, women do take FMLA and take paid leave when it's available more often than men do. In part, that's because that's what our culture expects, in part because women are earning lower wages. And so if one parent is going to take time to care for a new child, for example, or to care for a seriously ill family member, it often becomes the woman's job, quote unquote, to do that because they earn lower wages. And although they're contributing to their household income, it's often not as substantial as men, although women are increasingly key breadwinners in their families. But absolutely, FMLA is for both women and men. For self-care, so your own personal health condition, the split tends to be pretty even. And it's part of the reason why when we drafted the FMLA back all those years ago, it was so critically important to make it gender equal, because we didn't want to put in place a policy that was just reinforcing the idea that women are more expensive to hire or more problematic to have as employees or less reliable. We wanted to create a law that provided a baseline so that women could be workers, men could be caregivers, and employers wouldn't have reason to suspect, given the range of reasons that somebody could take FMLA, that it would just be women who were using it.
Yeah. We often say on the pod that economic justice is gender justice and vice versa.
Yeah, absolutely. Amen. Yeah.
And I also feel that there's like a stigma that women take care of the household or somehow bound more closely to the household and that therefore take the leave. When the FMLA was drafted, it was created to be a gender neutral solution, though that's not necessarily the case in practice. So does the National Partnership for Women and Families lobbying for additional protections? Are you trying to expand FMLA? What's the plan?
We are. And this is one of the most exciting things that we do. We and partners across the country have made huge progress over the last 5 years. So 5 years ago, we celebrated the 20th anniversary of the FMLA, and we did it in a way that really engendered, no pun intended, a lot of enthusiasm about the fight for paid family and medical leave. So California, where you are, was the first state to put a paid family leave program in place back in 2002, and it's been working for Californians since 2004. It's been expanded multiple times based on the needs of the workforce and the research that was coming back to say how the law could be more useful to California workers, could offer higher wage replacement, which makes it more possible for lower wage workers to take leave, makes it more possible for men to take leave. We've seen the family definition expanded, and we've seen job protection added for new parents. And that's been tremendous success and has shown a lot about what can be done through public policy. New Jersey and Rhode Island and New York all have paid family and medical leave programs in place. Washington State and Washington, D.C. both passed laws last year that'll be implemented in 2020. And at the federal level, we are learning from those state best practices, and we help to draft and are leading a broad and diverse advocacy coalition for a proposal called the Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act, or the FAMLI Act. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who I'm sure you know
fan
of.
Fan favorite.
fan favorite, yep. And Rosa DeLauro, who has spent her whole career fighting for women and for families, are the co-sponsors of this legislation that would guarantee 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave for all of those FMLA reasons that we talked about, new parent, new children, caring for a seriously ill loved one, your own serious health condition, military, family reasons. And it would do it in the way that we've learned works in the state. So creating a social insurance fund where small payroll deductions from employers and employees, or if you're self-employed, just yourself, pay in on average about $1.50 a week. It's 0.4% of your wages, or 4 cents for every $10 that you're paid, or that for employers, what they're paying to their workers. And you get 66% of your wages back up to a cap of $4,000 a month for the 12 weeks. And that's meant to set a baseline. Employers who want to be more generous could always do more. But what, you know, what I keep in mind and talk about literally each and every day is the startling fact that just 15% of the workforce has paid family leave through their jobs. And for low-wage workers, it's only 4%.
Wow.
So we're leaving out more than 100 million workers. And when you think about just personal medical leave, like you have a baby and you need to recover, or you get hit by a car, or, you know, you get a cancer diagnosis, just about 40% of the workforce has access to personal medical leave through an employer's temporary disability insurance program. Right. And startlingly, only two-thirds of the workforce has access to even paid sick time, which, again, California is one of the leaders on this, and LA, where you are, has a paid sick time law. But there are millions of people across the country that don't even have access to a single paid sick day. So we are really working to fill the gaps through public policy baselines here in the nation's capital.
Yeah, you said $1.50 a week, which just makes me think of the Paul Ryan tweet about the tax cut and how this woman was saving $1.50 a week and how
it's
that
so
was
funny
so
you
great.
Say that. Yeah. No. I so wanted to reply to that tweet to say you could put it into the Family Act fund and you would have access to paid family medical leave.
Right.
Yeah, I had the same thought.
Yeah. So I also want to ask, obviously, these statistics are alarming. Only 4% of low-wage workers having access to any sort of paid leave. Is the national partnership focusing on women of color and people of color specifically who are denied leave at higher rates than their white counterparts?
Yeah, no, this is a racial justice issue. It's a social and economic justice issue. And it's a gender justice issue. And we look at it from all of those perspectives. So we work closely with advocacy partners across the country, representing a diverse range of voices, including, you know, especially civil rights and racial justice groups, LGBTQ organizations, of course, women's organizations, children's organizations, seniors organizations, faith-based groups, business folks who have come to the table and said, we know that this is important for our workforce. It's important for their family members too, and it's important for our economy. And so we're not only going to do the right thing with respect to our employees, but we're also going to support public policy. Women and stories, often from low-wage workers and workers of color, are at the very center of this effort.
Yeah. So who or what is the main opposition to FMLA? You mentioned that H.W. Bush vetoed it. Why? Mm-hmm. What was the reason given? Even though both chambers passed the law.
Right. So back in the day, and it's incredibly amusing, but also pretty distressing to look back at some of the footage and the debates around FMLA. There were folks on the floor of Congress like John Boehner talking about how this was the downfall of capitalism and the economy was going to implode and companies were going to have to lay people off or outsource or shut down. And what is especially poignant this week is none of that happened.
Right.
I've been in conversations this week in sort of our FMLA retrospective with several members of Congress who were around at the time. And you talk to them about the FMLA fight and they say, man, those business lobbyists were in here and they were telling me that this was just going to kill their members and kill business. And, you know, and they sort of like smile wryly and say, and you know what? And then I say, none of that happened. And they say, you're right. But what to me actually this week was really fantastic is that a lot of our business organizing work over the last month has been to ask those companies that have led on leave to be part of our celebration. And so on Monday, the hashtag FMLA25 trended nationally for like 7 hours. And many of the handles that were tweeting out or blogging or writing LinkedIn posts were companies that were using the FMLA25 hashtag to talk about the value of leave and paid leave for their workers. And it was just such a poignant reflection of the fact that none of those business concerns that were articulated at the time came to pass. And in fact, you know, following the passage of the FMLA was one of the greatest expansions of economic growth that the country's ever had. So, you know, now fast forward 25 years and we're trying to pass a paid family and medical leave law that covers everybody, no matter where they work or who they work for or the job that they have. And we're hearing a lot of the same arguments. Businesses shouldn't have mandates, which, by the way, this isn't. But, you know, businesses shouldn't have mandates. We shouldn't tell the private sector what to do. Companies need to be able to make their own policies. This is going to cause us to, you know, lay off workers or cut wages. And it's just not true. We haven't seen any evidence of that happen over, you know, 15 years of close to 15 years of paid family leave in California. We haven't seen that happen in New Jersey through a Republican administration, Christie administration. Haven't seen that happen in Rhode Island in the last 3 years when the law's been in place. So this is a fallacy. And it is something that they say in part because there is just ideological opposition to the idea that we need to legislate in this area. But I do think the tide is turning. As I said, we've got business allies. We have a broad coalition. We're seeing now, you know, at least interest or articulate potential interest in Congress on the other side of the aisle, in states like Washington State, they passed an incredibly strong law with broad support on both sides of the aisle in the legislature and with the engagement of both large and small businesses. So I think the tide is turning, and that makes this a really exciting issue to be working on.
Speaking of today, kind of in the current political landscape, during the State of the Union, Trump had what felt like a throwaway line about this. He said, quote, and let's support working families by supporting paid family leave. I mean, in his first budget draft, he did include 6 weeks of paid family leave, though offered no specifics.
And only applied it to new parents, not to the 75% of people who take FMLA leave in a year, which is for yourself or a family member.
Right, right. And I think that was Ivanka Trump who was pushing this idea that 6 weeks paid leave, focusing on women who give birth and that recovery period, and didn't say anything about adoptive parents or LGBT parents or anything like that.
Well, that was during the campaign. So in the campaign, she only talked about birth moms. When they put their budget proposal out, I think they got enough blowback, including from people on their, you know, in their circle that said, no, you have to include dads and adoptive parents, too. So their budget proposal last year was 6 weeks of parental leave.
Got it.
But it, you know, too limited and, you know, not totally insufficient and potentially harmful.
Right. And so now in this past week, jumping on this sort of throwaway line, it looks like Marco Rubio and Ivanka Trump are trying to restart this debate. And what is their plan? Do you know what their plan is? And are they putting forth viable options?
So the plan that was reported on in the press last week or early this week, it's all blending together here, and then was the subject of a press conference this morning convened by the so-called Independent Women's Forum, which is not really independent and is notorious for being quite right-leaning, is to let people draw on their Social Security benefits for parental leave.
Right.
So you can take parental leave now and you can retire later, or you can take parental leave now and your retirement benefits are cut. And this is incredibly unhelpful.
Feels like a Faustian bargain.
Yeah, it's sort of like, well, you know, we have this, it's this false assumption that there's this limited pot of money. And so let's like squeeze it and let's squeeze it from an agency that's been chronically under-resourced and from a trust fund that already needs to be enhanced to accommodate the baby boom population aging. It's welcome to see the bipartisan interest. We have always said that this should be a bipartisan issue, just as the FMLA, as it moved through the process, was a bipartisan proposal. We believe the Family Act should be a bipartisan proposal, just as the New York and Washington state laws were. But this, the proposal that Ivanka Trump apparently is talking about, and that some members of the Senate, Rubio, Joni Ernst of Iowa, Mike Lee of Utah are talking about, is squeezing blood from a stone. Right. And especially on the backs of women who will be the ones most likely to take the leave, because again, the benefits are quite low, which makes it's going to make it hard to incentivize men to take leave. And women already have retirement benefits out of Social Security that are 20% lower than men's on average. And so what you're doing is taking an already limited retirement and making it more limited.
Yeah, that is going to make my head explode for the next couple of days. What's also interesting about that and squeezing this blood out of the Social Security stone, to use your turn of phrase, you know, in this tax reform bill that just passed, they've been talking a lot about cutting the quote unquote welfare state as it is. Is this just lip service?
You know, I don't know. I think that is a great question, and it's hard to tell. I think that they're reading the tea leaves, that paid family medical leave is a tremendously popular issue. It's got support from, you know, Republicans, 2/3 of Republicans, 75% of independents, more than 90% of Democrats, Republican and independent women in particular, really like paid family leave, like the idea of a national paid family leave plan. And, you know, things aren't going super well for them right now. and they need a kitchen table issue that looks proactive and forward looking. And, you know, I take that at face value. I take their overtures at face value because this is what I do for a living, and I need to find hope that we're going to reach a real, true bipartisan solution. But, you know, I think it's no surprise that they would want to put something forward that looks shiny and attractive to families. But we really need to dig deeper and look at what the research and evidence from the state plans and from the private sector tell us about how to structure a comprehensive, strong, affordable, and sustainable proposal. And creating a program out of Social Security without any new revenue, without adequate benefits, without meeting the needs of the growing aging population and family caregivers, this is unworkable and is misguided.
Do you think that Ivanka Trump pounced on this issue because she wanted to look like a feminist?
I mean, who knows what's in Ivanka Trump's head, right?
Like, pure speculation.
I think this is she is a working, you know, a working mom herself, as she says. She air quotes from you, and she is surrounded by other people close to her that are also women, you know, in their 30s and 40s with children. I think they feel this acutely. They've been in the financial services world and in the business world, and they see that this has been an impediment to the advancement of very elite women. And so I think that the interest may well be genuine.
Yeah.
But whether the proposals that are put forward reflect the needs of women who are not the upper echelon of society, that are, you know, the childcare workers and the grocery cashiers and teachers and managers, and, you know, any number of other professions in that 100 million people who don't have access to paid family leave. I think that's the, you know, $10 million question.
Yeah, I would be very interested to know if she gives paid leave to the caregivers of her children.
It's a great question.
It's a question for another day. So to close out every interview, Vicky, we like to ask for a gratitude check. These are trying times, and most of what we just talked about is going to keep me up at night for a while. So what is getting you through the day? So what are you grateful for?
Oh, that is such a great question. So I'm grateful to be doing this work, and I know that sounds cheesy, but I love this work. I love trying to make policy and culture better for working families and for women. And I love thinking about the fact that I can be part of making the change that will allow my son, who's turning 10 on Friday, to have a better life, and to be able to raise his own family maybe someday if he chooses to, in a more equitable society. And, you know, he is like the greatest feminist ever, which just gives me great joy. So that gives me gratitude today. Yeah, so much fun. This morning we were talking about something and he was like, "That's so sexist." Oh, the Lady Doritos.
Oh,
I was like,
yeah,
telling him about the Lady Doritos, and he was like, "What? That's so sexist, Mom."
Thank you so much, Vicky, for joining us. This was a great conversation. You can follow Vicky at VShabo, and you can follow National Partnership for Women and Families at NPWF. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Devin.
Okay, that is it for me today. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow me at Devin Handy, and you can follow the podcast at Hellbent Pod. I will see you back here with Drexel on Monday.